So thank you, everyone. Just as a sort of word of warning or preparation, at the end of the talk today, I thought we could share some prayers and prayer news as a church family. So if there's anything you've got that you'd like to share with us as a church family, then there'll be an opportunity to do that and we can pray for it together. It's good to be able to bring things together and to feel the sense of being church family. We're fairly small in number, really, but we're united by our faith in Jesus, a Jesus who can do the most amazing things. And that's really the heart of our message this morning as we look at Matthew chapter 8. So if you've got access to a Bible and you want to turn with me to these verses, that's really good. I'm going to read from verse 1 through to verse 13. So reading from verse 1. This is what it says. Words are also up on the screen there. When Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds came before him and followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. "Be clean." Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly." Jesus said to him, "Shall I come and heal him?" The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the words, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, there are soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. And he said to those following him, "Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, let it be done just as you believed it would." And his servant was healed at that moment. Well, these are two amazing stories that we're going to be thinking a bit about this morning. Two miracles that Jesus seems to perform that lead to incredible change for those impacted by them. I wonder, first of all, though, what you think about this issue of being popular or unpopular. If you can remember back to your school days, which, they may have been a few years ago, were you a popular person at school or were you sometimes a bit unpopular? When I was a kid, my family moved around quite a bit, so I was often the new kid in school. And the thing about being a new kid in school, if you've been in that position, is you'll know that two options really are available to you. You can either be very, very popular, because you are, after all, the new kid in school, and everyone wants to know the new kid. Or things might not go off to a fantastic start, and you can end up being a bit unpopular, because you are, after all, the new kid in school. Thankfully, in my experience, things fairly settled out quite quickly, and you found your way in the particular chain that was school. But nonetheless, it's an experience of being either very popular or unpopular. Today, we encounter two people who in Israel at the time of Jesus would actually have been really quite unpopular. Two very different outcasts who were about to encounter Jesus and see their lives transformed as a result. A leper, for that's what we're told, we're not told his name, and a centurion. And again, we're not told that person's name either. Two very different outcasts. And two incidents which make me wonder different things. I wonder, first of all, are there people today who I would prefer to avoid? Who are the people that I avoid who Jesus loved to encounter? It's quite a challenging thought as we look at these two stories. And I wonder, too, about the level of faith that these two very different people displayed. What sort of faith, I wonder, do I actually practice? Do I have the sort of faith that would take a huge issue like that to Jesus, believing that as a result, Jesus would make a huge difference? I also wonder about the transformation that was experienced. Do I really believe that Jesus has the power to really radically change the lives of people today? Well, let's set things in context a little bit. From the beginning of Matthew chapter 8, all the way through to Matthew chapter 9, right about verse 34, we encounter 9 different miracle stories. Each of the stories, because it's Matthew writing it, is brief. We get the bare outline of what happens. We're missing huge amounts of detail that our inquiring minds would quite like to have filled in. Names, for example. Something else, like what did happen afterwards? You know, were their lives really transformed for a long time? And if so, what kind of people did they become? I suppose, actually, I'm quite grateful we're missing that level of detail, because each story, it would probably be a full book in itself. Matthew is brief because his focus is on Jesus. Like a student tasked with writing a thesis but limited to a certain number of words, Matthew has gone over his accounts and edited and edited until we're left with the essential information that has the ability to enable us to encounter Jesus and be transformed as a result. Matthew wants our attention to be firmly focused on the person and the work of Jesus Christ. And Jesus, who as these accounts show, appears to have an irresistible authority. I wonder if we could think about something horrible and just plain yuck. Can you think of something really, really horrible? What is the yuckiest thing that you've really been confronted or had to encounter? Can you think this morning of your greatest gross moment? Turn to the person next to you and share, I said share, not reenact, your greatest gross moments. Okay, 2 minutes. Can you share something that was really just yuck? Okay, it's gone reasonably quiet, so I'm assuming that you've either made each other feel really unwell and you've gone quiet, or you're not too much like that. I suppose it's only fair then that I should try and think of my own greatest gross moment, something that was really yuck and horrible. I was thinking, I wonder what I could mention, and I thought, I know one I could bring up, literally. So our kids remember it quite frequently. It happened in Anne's lovely car. Anne and the kids had picked me up. And on the way home, in Anne's really nice, clean car, I was really, really sick. The kids like to remind me of this. In fairness, I should add, just to set the context, Anne had picked me up from hospital, and I had had an anaesthetic. And you know what they do in hospitals after you've kind of come around from whatever they've done? They give you toast and juice to make sure you're all right. Well, they failed to check that I was all right, and I wasn't quite all right. I was still really a bit unwell from it. And it was really horrible. What was particularly horrible is that Anne made me clean the car. And as we didn't have a dog at the time, that was meant it fell to me to clean it up. Now at least the dog can deal with that kind of situation, should the need arise. Well, they've got to have some use, haven't they? That and washing the dishes. I think the dog is ideally designed to wash the dishes. He can lick at the front and wipe clean dry with his tail at the back. It's fantastic. Now, imagine for a moment you are listening to Matthew's account. It's being read out, as it probably would have done nearly 2,000 years ago. People would be sitting down, and this account would be getting read out for you. Just before we start this, Matthew says what appears to be the most awful and grossest thing people can think of. Matthew says to his audience, if you can imagine, what's the worst thing you can think of, just like I did there. What's the grossest thing you can think of, audience? And they're all sitting there thinking, hold on, we know what the worst thing is we can think of. We know what the most horrible thing is we can think of. Matthew, the answer is leprosy. Not only was it gross, but it was something that everybody feared. In first century Palestine, leprosy was almost like having a death sentence. Though, of course, it didn't actually kill you, at least not initially. You see, leprosy was an illness that disfigured you, but also prevented you from taking on work, and therefore you lost your income. It also got you thrown out of your home. It was highly infectious and nobody wanted to catch it. Therefore, you weren't allowed to be in your village, your work, or even with your family. Not only could you not see your friends, your work colleagues, or family, but you were also banned from entering the synagogue. So therefore, you couldn't worship God with other people. The only people lepers could meet were other lepers. So it was an illness that was not only considered gross because it disfigured you, but it was considered highly infectious. Therefore, it was feared, made you someone nobody wanted to be with. As I was preparing this, I thought, well, I wonder what the situation's like today. Can you still even get leprosy today? So I came across this little video, which I think we could watch just now, which was done by the Leprosy Mission, which tells us a little bit about what leprosy is like today.
I support the Leprosy Mission because all my life what I've tried to do, both in parliamentary terms and in terms of the charities with which I'm associated, is to make a difference, and therefore I support organisations which really do make a direct and visible and discernible difference. A leprosy mission does far more than just come along with a cure and say, yippee, your leprosy's gone. It will do much more than that. If the leprosy has already taken hold and people are sometimes quite seriously disabled as a result, then work opportunities, reskilling, retraining, all those things are supplied. Above all, education is supplied. People die of ignorance or they become disabled through ignorance. That can be stopped if they understand what leprosy is. In a very different way now, leprosy still brings about social exclusion because people are so afraid of it. There's a lot of myth, a lot of ignorance. And of course, there is also real social exclusion because if people have had leprosy and it hasn't been cured in time, they can end up seriously disabled and unable to function, sometimes in societies where it really is survival of the fittest, where if you're not fit, you really can't work, you really can't make a living, you're at the top of nobody's scale. And so there is still a huge amount of social exclusion, even if we're not in the realms of ghettos and bell ringing, there's still quite enough social exclusion connected to leprosy. Well, the Leprosy Mission doesn't just take in a medical cure and say, oh, yippee, your leprosy's gone. That actually, though it's an important part of it, is only a part of it. First of all, there's education, so that people can understand about leprosy, can learn not to fear it, can learn to identify it early, can learn the sort of help they need to get early. That's crucially important. The second thing is, what about the people who've had it over a prolonged period before it was dealt with? They're likely to be severely disabled. It's bad enough for the disabled in advanced Western countries sometimes to get the job opportunities and the training and to be fully a part of the community. Out in those parts of the world where leprosy abounds, it's even more impossible, and it can make the difference between survival and non-survival, how well equipped you are to deal with a disability. Leprosy Mission does that. But the Leprosy Mission also takes the message to the rest of the world and says, look, do you realise this didn't die out 2,000 years ago? New cases, 250,000 of them, are being reported every year. I think there are two main ways in which we can help in the West. The first is the very obvious one, the one every charity calls for, every mission calls for, which is money. But nevertheless, money makes a difference. money for the medical cures, money for purifying the water supply, money for retraining those who may be disabled, money for education. It all takes money. But there's something else that we can do. We can just simply raise awareness. Now, those who can't give a penny can raise awareness, because people think leprosy's gone. It hasn't gone. There are 250,000 new cases every year. And what we can do here in the West is just raise awareness. Leprosy's still with us. It didn't die out 2,000 years ago with the death of Christ. It actually is still with us. And it is a growing phenomenon in some countries.
Okay, there we go. So leprosy was and still is a horrible illness, still one that impacts many, many lives today. In Jesus' day, the religious law forbids anyone who had leprosy from coming into contact with someone who was healthy. And we can understand why. Given the medical conditions and medical facilities around, it was highly contagious and therefore highly feared. No one wanted to catch it. Is there an equivalent to leprosy in our society today? Which makes me wonder, who are the people I tend to avoid? Now, looking around here from my privileged position at the front, I can see that we're all fairly comfortable. We're also fairly comfortable to be here in your seats at the moment. Unless I say something really bizarre, you're all fairly safe and happy there. You can sit there quite comfortably for the next 30 or 40 minutes. Yeah, I know, it's like that most Sundays, obviously. But what if there were to be people here who made us feel a bit uncomfortable? Now, I was trying to think, what sort of people might we be talking about? Now, I don't want to get into this whole Brexit thing. You know, I carefully avoid it most of the time. But, you know, imagine we had a bunch of Europeans come to church, for example. You know the sort of people, I mean, not just people from the nice European countries, but places that are really a long way away and very strange, like Belgium, for instance. Would you feel comfortable coming to church if we had Belgians in the church? Or, you know, or a country that we don't particularly like because it's in the news a lot and we fear, I don't know, I don't know which country, you can pick your own one. The thing is that nearly every church you see, whether it's online or in a leaflet or whatever on its notice board, it will say, welcome. Or it may even write things like, everyone is welcome here. We say it too, don't we? We have a team of people to try and welcome you on a Sunday morning. But I just wonder, is that really true? It should be. But I'm not so sure it is all the time. And even looking around here, you know, if our church just contains people who pretty much look like me or act and behave like me, then I wonder if that's really church. Look at what happens in chapter 8. Let me just pick up this. I've got it right in front of me. Jesus is coming down a mountainside. He is surrounded by large crowds. I don't know what the equivalent image might be, but it's not just, I suppose it's maybe like someone famous or a celebrity coming into town. Clearly he's not being surrounded by people taking photographs or the flashing of camera lenses, because that still had to be invented. But we've got people pushing in, trying to get a glimpse, trying to be near this person who has become something of a celebrity in the local area. People have heard about his teachings. People have heard about the miracles that he's done. They want to get a little bit of the action by being as close to him as possible. In addition, we've got Jesus' 12 disciples almost in effect acting like minders. They're trying to push people out of the way. You can see it's a noisy scene. There's an element of chaos about it. But Jesus is still nonetheless making progress to where he wants to go. He is, as we know, someone on a mission. He is, as we know, someone who's got a lot to do in a very short space of time. He's important. The most important person that's ever walked on earth. And someone interrupts his progress. A man, we are told, comes and kneels before Jesus. Only this is no ordinary man. This is a man with leprosy, we're told, who comes and kneels before Jesus. And you can almost hear the gasp as the crowd stops, steps back, and looks in horror. How did this person get in here? Secondly, who's he touched? Which one of us has touched him? I hope you didn't touch him. You didn't touch him. Did you touch him? And then people sort of, as they step back, trying to make as much space as possible between them and this person with this feared illness, they hear these words, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. What, I wonder, would you have done in this situation? Here's the thing, I reckon I too would have stood back in shock. There are many people I avoid. Being a good sort of British person, I like to think that I'm not discriminatory. And maybe by the codes and laws our society sets, maybe I do okay. But compared to Jesus, I really haven't even begun to get what it's like to accept anyone. Who is it I avoid? Another question becomes, what sort of faith do I really practice? Matthew's short and detailed here, and it's a little frustrating because our inquiring minds would like a bit more information. How, for example, had this man with leprosy heard about Jesus? We don't know. No information there. How had he got this close to Jesus without someone stopping him? We can only presume that anyone who saw him stepped back, therefore allowing him to almost have the VIP fast-track access to Jesus. The thing is, we don't need that information. All we know through his actions is that he believed that an encounter with Jesus would transform his life. Otherwise, why bother? Why take all this risk upon you, all this further humiliation upon a life that's already had its fair share of humiliation? Through his actions, this man practiced his faith. All he knew was that if he encountered Jesus, his life would be transformed. Do you and I believe that an encounter with Jesus transforms lives? Is that the sort of faith that we practice day by day? You might be saying, well, this is all sounding like you could be heading towards naivety street, Keith. Let me say, we don't need to be naive on this point. If we genuinely welcome all people, then we'll have to accept that we'll get with them the messes and the sins thrown in. If we welcome someone whose particular sin may be stealing stuff, then we can expect stuff to get stolen until they change, or if they're lying, or if they're leopards. People will remain in that position until they really encounter Jesus. True, we shouldn't be naive, but nor must we lack faith either. Jesus is more than willing to still change lives today. I think it's really interesting what the leper says to Jesus. And this is, I'm afraid, the only name I can give him. It's the only name I'm told. Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. I think that's a very odd sentence. Don't you think that? Why did he say that? He didn't say, Lord, you are willing. Can you make me clean? He said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. In other words, the faith that he practices, you know, Jesus, I know you can do this. No doubt about it. But what I don't know is if you're willing to accept someone like me. In a sense, the religious practices of those around him really gave him that answer anyway. They said, leopards are not welcome in our religious practices. You're unclean. Get out of here. In other words, the practice to date was, God, you're not willing. You can make me clean, but God, you're not willing because you don't even want me around. Jesus comes along. Whatever he's heard about Jesus suggests that the current practice ain't like that. Jesus is the Son of God, but he's like no representative of God that's ever been around before. You can make me clean, yes, but are you willing? Have things changed enough that someone like me can be accepted? Look what Jesus does. Jesus reaches out his hand and touches that man. As Jesus reaches out his hand, you can hear yet further gasps of shock. If it was bad that such an unclean person had got near Jesus, it was horrific that Jesus, who was at this point considered to be a rabbi, a teacher, Jewish teacher, had touched this man. It was horrific in all sorts of different ways. First of all, it broke their religious custom. You weren't supposed to touch this person. They were supposed to send them away. Secondly, it broke the customs that every person knew they had to follow. You do not touch people with this illness, because if you touch them, you've made yourself unclean. And in the absence of any medical treatment, which there was none, you are now a leper too. Jesus is now as good as the walking dead. He has now made himself one of them. Jesus' love for this man is far more powerful than his fear or his concern for social norms. Do you and I love Jesus the way Jesus loves us? Love is messy. That's true. We can't be naive about it. It comes with all sorts of risks and complications. But love is dangerous too. Love is risk-taking. And love can be really unpopular. Jesus touches him and says to this man, "I am willing. Be clean." Love is many things, but in Jesus it is also miraculous. This is the power of Jesus to really radically change lives. And surely this is the thing this morning for us. Dare we see people the way Jesus saw people? The people saw a leper, and their reaction was that of a society that distrusted and would not take that. Jesus saw a man who could be healed. And I wonder this morning if we dare to see people the way Jesus saw people. Our second miracle, which we'll cover just very briefly because that's all we got time for. The people saw a representative of a hated foreign army. Jesus saw a man whose beloved servant was suffering. When we start to see people the way Jesus sees people, things change. If we're to say that people are welcome here, then we better mean that we welcome them the way Jesus understood it. You're welcome here regardless of your background or regardless of the label that we've put on you just now. You're welcome here if you're a manager for a big company, you're really stressed out. You're welcome here if actually some of the actions you've taken have been less than honorable. You've been a bit of a liar and a cheat, to be honest. You're welcome here regardless of your race, your religion, or even, dare I say it, your sexual orientation. You're welcome here if you do drugs and if you don't. You're welcome here if you're generally on the wrong side of everything that we believe the Bible says to be right. You're welcome here because when Jesus looks down and sees you, he sees something amazing and beautiful, just like he does when he looks down and sees me. And when I look at you, I need to learn to look at you the way Jesus sees you. We're not here yet, but we are starting on that direction, because we believe that Jesus is a place, a church, where Jesus can be encountered and lives transformed. Because it's these two miracles from those nine particular ones that Matthew has picked out, as they show when anyone encounters Jesus, they are changed. Whenever someone comes to Jesus, no one who encounters Jesus leaves unchanged. Let's pray just for a moment. Then I'm going to invite John actually up, if John's in this bit of the room. That'd be great. So I'm just going to say a little prayer, then invite John out. So